Chapter 17, The Vine of the Dead. What are the Amazonian geoglyphs? Why did the ancients go to such trouble to make these colossal earthworks? Why is geometry their most obvious theme? And to what extent, if any, since stone circles are frequently associated with similar earthworks elsewhere, does the presence of stone circles in the Amazon help us to understand the geoglyphs? So far, we've considered only geometry and certain cosmic alignments, but my hypothesis in both cases, and in the case of the extraordinarily similar earthquakes of the Mississippi Valley that we'll explore in parts 5 and 6, is that we are dealing with memes here. Moreover, it is a phenomenon in itself that the same memes appear again and again among seemingly unrelated cultures of both the Old World and the New World, separated sometimes not only by thousands of miles, but by thousands of years. Much more work will be required to establish when the memes of geometry and cosmic alignment first took root in the Amazon. Archaeology on its own is of limited use to us here, since so little has been done, even at the sites already discovered, and since so much of the region has never been investigated at all. What would help would be a much more thorough and detailed archaeoastronomical survey of Rego Grande and of other stone circles in its vicinity than has already been undertaken. In parallel, as I argued earlier, an equally thorough archaeoastronomical survey of the Amazonian geoglyphs is a must if we are to refine not only our understanding of their geometry, but also to tease out any cosmic alignments they may contain. Since no such study has yet been undertaken, all we can say for sure is that some of the geoglyphs reviewed in Chapter 15 are definitely cosmically aligned. We've heard, for example, that both Fazenda Piranha and Severino Calazans consist of square geoglyphs. The first features two squares, one 200 meters along each side and the second exactly half that size, with an interconnecting causeway. Meanwhile, the second site has side lengths of 230 meters, giving it the same footprint as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. All four of these squares, the two at Fazenda Piranha, the one at Severino Calazans, and of course the Great Pyramid itself, are cardinally oriented. That is, their sides face true north, south, east, and west. The most basic and obvious of the cosmic alignments shared across these sites are therefore to the celestial north and south poles, the points on the celestial sphere directly above the Earth's geographic north and south poles, around which the stars and planets appear to rotate during the course of the night, and to the points of sunrise and sunset on the spring and autumn equinoxes, when the sun rises perfectly due east and sets perfectly due west. We've also heard that other great earthworks of the Amazon feature strong northwest to southeast orientations. This would put the investigation of possible solstitial alignments, and also of lunar standstill alignments, of which more in Part 5, at the top of the list of priorities if any proper archaeoastronomical survey should ever be undertaken. I think it likely that such a survey of the Amazonian geoglyphs, as of the stone circles, would reveal many more and far more intricate cosmic alignments, perhaps even as subtle and complex as the multiple alignments found at the Great Pyramid, Stonehenge, and Serpent Mound. There's little point in speculating further on such matters when we don't have the necessary data from the Amazon. For the sake of argument, however, let's assume that the memes of geometry and cosmic alignment are part of a connected system there, as they are in so many other parts of the world where the required research has already been done. In that case, we can say, on the basis of the equinoctial and solstitial alignments at Pinal do Pilau, the single Amazonian site where something approaching a thorough archaeoastronomical study has been undertaken, that the system must have reached Amazonia at least 13,000 years ago. That it should then have later iterations in different media, such as the stone circle at Rego Grande and the great cosmically aligned geoglyphs at Severino Calazans and Fazenda Piranha, should not surprise us. We are dealing, I believe, with deliberately created memes here, memes that have a deeply mysterious purpose and that function in ineffable ways. They are transmitted by repetition and replication, which explains their similarities. But cultures, once separated, tend to evolve and develop in their own distinctive and quirky fashion. We can therefore expect that not only the media and materials through which the memes are made manifest, but also their local interpretation will vary greatly through time and between one part of the world and another, while nonetheless retaining a constant core of unvarying central ideas. Western science wades in. The first efforts of Western scientists to interpret the geoglyphs of Amazonia were predictably utilitarian and reductionist, with attempts being made to persuade us that the great geometrical earthworks must have been built for defensive purposes. But with no evidence of warfare around them, with the ditches clearly not moats, since so many of them are placed within the earthen embankments rather than outside them, and with no evidence of palisade walls, for example in the form of post holes or wooden remains, this theory soon lost favor. Not only was there no evidence of warfare, but actually very little at all in the way of archaeological materials, pottery, figurines, refuse, etc., that would help to decipher the use, meaning, and purpose of the geoglyphs. The consensus now, therefore, is that they were created for ritual, spiritual, religious, and ceremonial purposes. William Bali, professor of anthropology at Tulane University, is a supporter of this new consensus, but is doing no more than stating the obvious when he suggests that the spiritual religious role of the Amazonian glyphs must in some way have involved geometry and gigantism. Well, yes, Professor, obviously, but in what way and to what purposes? If we seek useful answers to such questions, rather than easy inferences or mere descriptions of these gigantic geometric patterns, then we are going to have to do what a very few Western scientists, to their credit, are now doing, and that is to consult indigenous peoples still living in the Amazon today. Finnish scholars Sanna Sauna-Luoma and Pirjo Kristina Virtanen have led the way in this fresh approach. The cultural destruction of the past 5 centuries has wiped many of the tribal memory banks clean. The ongoing process of imposed amnesia that has left us so bereft of knowledge about the ancient Amazon. It is clear, however, that all is not yet lost. In 2013, for example, Sauna-Luoma and Virtanen brought a group of 5 Manchineri, an indigenous tribe living today in the region of the earthworks, to visit Jakosar. This immense geoglyph, depicting a circle within a square, as the listener will recall, is located about 250 kilometers from their territory. The investigators report that the Manchineri immediately reported feeling sensations of being in an ancient ritual atmosphere. Moreover, they said that their ancestors had talked about these types of places, although they could not offer any explanation as to why the earthwork ditches were so deep or even why they had been constructed. A second local tribal group, the Apurina, narrated that their parents had advised them to pass by the earthworks quickly and avoid their vicinity when possible because they signify difference, promote avoidance, and are regarded as enchanted or miraculous places. Certainly then, at least the traces of a memory of how significant the earthworks must have been in their prime and of the awe that they formerly inspired lingers on in local superstitions and folklore. But a reservoir of much more detailed information has been stored away in the Amazon, and here too, Sauna-Luoma and Virtanen are pioneers in finding links to the earthworks. The shamanistic cosmos. Some of the clues they have drawn on have been available for more than 130 years. They're found in the account, given in the last chapter, of the worship of geometrical gods by the Arawana people, in the vicinity of the geoglyphs when Colonel Antonio R.P. Labre stayed among them in 1887. From Labre, we also learn that the Arawanas had temples and a form of worship, and that their religious officiants were medicine men. During the 20th century, the term medicine men went out of fashion, and where indigenous systems of spirituality are still practiced in the Amazon today, the majority of ethnographic and anthropological studies define the officiants as shamans. This word is not derived from or used in any Amazonian language. It comes instead from the Tungus-Mongol noun saman, meaning broadly, one who knows. Its widespread use by anthropologists today not only with reference to religious ritual functionaries in the Amazon, but also to similar figures who are found in tribal and hunter-gatherer societies all over the world, has not come about because the Tungus mysteriously contacted and influenced other cultures, but because Tungus shamanism was the first example of the phenomenon to be studied by European ethnologists. The Tungus word entered Western languages through their enthusiastic written reports and has subsequently continued to be applied in all parts of the world where systems very similar to Tungus shamanism have been found. It is the shaman, usually a man but sometimes a woman, who stands at the heart of these systems. And what all shamans have in common, regardless of which culture they come from or what they call themselves, is an ability to enter and control altered states of consciousness. Often, but not always, psychedelic plants or fungi are consumed to attain the necessary trance state. Shamanism, therefore, is not primarily a set of beliefs, nor the result of purposive study. It is, first and foremost, mastery of the techniques needed to attain trance, and thus to occasion particular kinds of experiences. Shamans call them visions. Western psychiatrists call them hallucinations, that are then in turn used to interpret events and guide behavior. The true shaman must attain his knowledge and position through trance, vision, and soul journey to the other world. All these states of enlightenment are reached during a shamanic state of consciousness and not by purposive study and application of a corpus of systematic knowledge. Such a method of knowledge acquisition seems absurd and fantastical to the rational Western mind. And indeed, underlying the whole notion of soul journeys to the other world is a model of reality that is diametrically opposed in every way to the model presently favored by Western science. This remotely ancient shamanistic model holds our material world to be much more complicated than it seems to be. Behind it, beneath it, above it, interpenetrating it, all around it, sometimes symbolized as being underground or sometimes in the sky, is an other world, perhaps multiple other worlds, spirit worlds, underworlds, nether worlds, etc., inhabited by supernatural beings. Whether we like it or not, we must interact with these non-physical beings, which, though generally invisible and intangible, have the power both to harm us and to help us. The geometrical pulse. The big picture of shamanism, altered states of consciousness, and their immensely important place in the human story, was the focus of my 2005 book, Supernatural: Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. I refer the listener to that book for a comprehensive body of data that reinforces and underlines what I have to say in this chapter. Meanwhile, the key point, standing right at the heart of the matter, and nonsensical to rational Western minds, is the notion that the human condition requires interaction with powerful, non-physical beings. Across much of the Amazon, the nexus that facilitates such interaction is the extraordinary visionary brew ayahuasca, a plant medicine that has been in use among indigenous peoples of this vast region for unknown thousands of years. Its active ingredient, derived from the leaves of the chacruna shrub, botanical name Psychotria viridis, is dimethyltryptamine, DMT, an immensely potent hallucinogen. It is from the other ingredient, however, derived from the Banisteriopsis carpi vine, that the brew gets its name. The function of the ayahuasca vine in the brew is to transmit a monoamine oxidase inhibitor into the bloodstream of the recipient, so that he or she may gain sustained access to the extraordinary effects of DMT, a substance that is normally neutralized in the gut by the enzyme monoamine oxidase. There are other ways of accessing the visionary power of Amazonian plants rich in DMT, notably by snorting them as snuff, but the effects are short-lasting. Taken orally, in the form of the ayahuasca brew, however, the experience can last up to 6 hours, permitting a much more sustained and immersive trance journey. It is, in my view, a remarkable scientific feat that such a highly effective combination of just two out of the estimated 150,000 different species of plants, trees, and vines in the Amazon was discovered by mere trial and error. Nor, if you ask Amazonian shamans, as I have done, how their ancestors made this discovery, will they admit to trial and error at all, or indeed to any other method that Western science would recognize as rational. What they claim, very simply, but unanimously, is that a variety of plant spirits, among which ayahuasca is paramount, have taught them everything important they need to know about the properties of other plants in the jungle, thus allowing them to make powerful medicines to heal the sick and, in general, to be good doctors. Ayahuasca itself is said to be a doctor, possessing a strong spirit, and is considered to be an intelligent being with which it is possible to establish rapport and from which it is possible to acquire knowledge and power. The anthropologist Angelica Gebhardt-Sayer, who studied the Shipibo-Conibo people of the Amazon, notes that under the influence of ayahuasca, the shaman perceives, from the spirit world, incomprehensible, often chaotic information in the form of luminous designs. As Gebhardt-Sayer sees it, it is the shaman's function to decode and domesticate this raw, unprocessed data beamed at him by the plant spirits by converting it into therapy for the tribe as a whole. Very often, these luminous designs, rich in data, take the form of geometry. I speak from experience, having participated in more than 70 ayahuasca sessions since 2003, continuing to work with the brew for the valuable lessons it teaches me long after Supernatural was researched, written, and published. Here's part of my account of the first time I drank ayahuasca in the Amazon. I raised the cup to my lips again. About two-thirds of the measure that the shaman poured for me still remains, and now I drain it in one draft. The concentrated bittersweet foretaste, followed instantly by the aftertaste of rotten medicine, hits me like a punch in the stomach. Feeling slightly apprehensive, I thank the shaman and wander back to my place on the floor. Time passes, but I don't keep track of it. I've improvised a pillow from a rolled-up sleeping bag, and I now find I'm swamped by a powerful feeling of weariness. My muscles involuntarily relax. I close my eyes, and without fanfare, a parade of visions suddenly begins. Visions that are at once geometrical and alive. Visions of lights unlike any light I've ever seen. Dark lights, a pulsing, swirling field of the deepest luminescent violets, of reds emerging out of night, of unearthly textures of colors, of solar systems revolving, of spiral galaxies on the move. Visions of nets and strange ladder-like structures, visions in which I seem to see multiple square screens stacked side by side and on top of each other to form immense patterns of windows arranged in great banks. Though they manifest without sound, in what seems to be a pristine and limitless vacuum, the images possess a most peculiar and particular quality. They feel like a drum roll, as though their real function is to announce the arrival of something else. Other notes I made following my ayahuasca sessions in the Amazon refer to a geometrical pulse, to a recurrence of the geometrical patterns, to a background of shifting geometrical patterns, and to complex, interlaced patterns of geometry. I zoom in for a closer view. They're rectangular, outlined in black, like windows. There's a circle in the center of each rectangle. Paths. Those sessions took place in January and February 2004, some years before I first learned of the existence of the great geometrical geoglyphs of the Amazon. The listener will understand, therefore, that when I began to research the glyphs in 2017 and to wonder about their meaning to whichever unknown peoples created them, it was natural for me to consider ayahuasca as an inspiration. I can't confirm whether any circles within rectangles are among the more than 550 geoglyphs discovered by 2018, but Jacosar, where the Manchineri group brought by Sauno Luoma and Vertanen reported sensations of being in an ancient ritual atmosphere, certainly gives us a circle within a square. And while the geometrical patterns that I likened to multiple square screens and banks of windows might be described and manifesting using very different materials in very different ways by people from very different cultural backgrounds, what seems to stay constant throughout is the geometry. It is the fundamental motif of the earthworks, but it turns up in much else besides. For example, in the ayahuasca-inspired art of the Tucano of the Colombian Amazon, where the brew goes by the name of Yahe. The Tucano create geometrical patterns and abstract designs in sand, on fabrics and musical instruments, on their houses, and on the communal malocas where they consume yaje. Colombian anthropologist Gerardo Reichel-Dolmatov reported the results of an intriguing experiment he carried out in which he asked members of a Tucano community to make crayon drawings of what they saw when they were drinking yaje. The drawings were, of course, made from memory after the drinkers had returned to everyday consciousness. The results, broadly identical to the designs on the houses and fabrics, included a triangle flanked by vertical lines ending in spirals, a rhomboid, a rectangular design filled with parallel lines, patterns of parallel undulating lines drawn horizontally, a number of different oval and U-shaped elements, rows of dots or small circles, a vertical pattern of little dots, grid patterns, zigzag lines, nested rectangles, nested parallel arcs, catenary curves, and so on. Significantly, the Tucano also paint identical shapes and patterns on rock faces in the hills of the northwestern Amazon. More than 70 different indigenous Amazonian cultures use ayahuasca, many giving different names to the brew: yaje, natema, capi, tipo, shori, etc. Since almost all report seeing geometrical visions, I wasn't surprised to discover that Sauno Luoma and Virtanen were already far ahead of me in contemplating a connection between ayahuasca visions as expressed in indigenous art and the immense geoglyphs now emerging from jungle clearances along the southern rim of the Amazon. Of the contemporary Manchineri, for example, who live much closer to the ancient earthworks than the Tucano, they note in a 2015 paper that certain geometric motifs, often expressed in ceramics and body paintings, have meanings as signs of specific ancestors. Some ancestors possess their own geometric designs that may appear in shamanic ayahuasca visions, transmitting ancestral knowledge and power. They therefore conclude that not only using but also constructing geometric earthworks may have been important social intragroup or intergroup events. In a follow-up paper published in American Anthropologist in August 2017, Sauno Luoma and Virtanen take their analysis much further, proposing that the geoglyphs were systematically constructed as spaces especially laden with visible and invisible entities. Their argument is that, regardless of scale or medium, the whole process of materializing visionary iconography in particular geometric patterns is related to the fluid forms inhabiting the Amazonian relational world. Different designs bring the presence of non-humans to the visible world of humans for a number of Amazonian indigenous peoples, while perceiving geometric designs in Amerindian art as paths from one dimension to another allows a viewer to shift between different worlds from the visible to the invisible. Citing the work of their colleague Luisa Belaunde, Sauno Luoma and Virtanen note that for the Shipibo Conibo of the Peruvian Amazon, the lines embody a package of ways in which beings move, travel, communicate between themselves, and transmit knowledge, objects, and powers. These paths exist everywhere, from macro to micro scales. Geometric designs are thus about certain ways of thinking, perceiving, and indicating visible aspects so they can be seen. Sauno Luoma and Virtanen further established that to the Shipibo Conibo, the geometric lines open a window to the macrocosmos and allow macrocosmic order to be iconically sketched in the microcosmos here in landscape designs. As above, so below. Portal. By taking the worldview, insights, and philosophies of indigenous peoples seriously in efforts to understand their past, Sauno Luoma and Virtanen's research marks a refreshing change of note for Western science and offers rewarding insights into the realm of ideas underlying the geoglyphs. It is by no means a realm of primitive ideas. On the contrary, with its notions of pathways between dimensions and of making visible the presence of usually invisible entities, there are aspects of thought surrounding the traditional use of ayahuasca that would not be out of place in a quantum physics laboratory. Once again, I suggest we are looking at the remnants of an advanced system that propagates itself through time and across cultures with powerful memes, among which geometry and cosmic alignments take a large share. We do not know where or when this system originated, In the ancient Amazon, however, to a greater degree than anywhere else, its dissemination became integrated with the use of vision-inducing plants. And there, up to the present day, the secrets of how to use these plants have been preserved and passed down within indigenous shamanic traditions. The origin myth of the Tucano speaks of the time, aeons ago, when humans first settled the great rivers of the Amazon basin. It seems that supernatural beings accompanied them on this journey and gifted them the fundamentals upon which to build a civilized life. From the daughter of the sun, they received the gift of fire and the knowledge of horticulture, pottery making, and many other crafts. The serpent-shaped canoe of the first settlers was steered by a superhuman helmsman. Meanwhile, other supernaturals traveled by canoe over all the rivers and explored the remote hill ranges. They pointed out propitious sites for houses or fields or for hunting and fishing, and they left their lasting imprint on many spots so that future generations would have ineffaceable proof of their earthly days and would forever remember them and their teachings. The slow, methodical process of the serpent canoe, setting down its cargo of migrants here and there, explains anthropologist Gerardo Rachel Dormadoff, was marked not only by the successive spots of debarkation, but also by an advancing scale of human achievement. The rules for the initiation into shamanism were laid down, accompanied by a large body of prescriptions, regulations, and prohibitions that from now on were to guide and govern the life of the people. But above all, if mankind was to prevail and survive as part of nature, and was to pass on a true legacy to new generations, people had to assume responsibilities and find ways to control the organization of society so as to procure a balance between human needs and the resources available in nature. In this period, the spirit beings prepared the land so that mortal human creatures might live on it. Once that task had been completed, however, the supernatural beings returned to their otherworldly abodes. Before leaving, they took care to provide mankind with the means of communication, of establishing contact with them whenever there should be need. Mortal men could not be left alone without the possibility of communing with the spirit world. It was essential then for the welfare of mankind to have at its disposal a simple and effective means by which at any given moment an individual or a group of people could establish contact with the supernatural sphere. It is rather brutally to compress many colorful and thought-provoking details to say that at the end of the lengthy myth, the effective means of contacting the spirit world turns out to be ayahuasca, a plant that opened the door into another dimension, a drug that produced visions in which the spirit beings revealed themselves to men, talking, teaching, admonishing, and protecting. There are multiple different elements intertwined in the Tucano story, but three of them stand out for me. First, what's being described is dressed up in the language and imagery of myth, and may, of course, be just a myth. What it sounds like, however, is a mythologized account of a settlement mission in the Amazon in which a group of migrants were accompanied by a number of more sophisticated people considered to be supernatural or superhuman. Though I don't want to put undue weight on it, I would be negligent if I failed to mention in passing that the Tucano and the closely related Barasana are among a number of Amazonian tribes whose distinctive men's cults are paralleled by virtually identical institutions in Melanesia on the opposite side of the Pacific Ocean. As the listener will discover in Appendix 1, the same secrecy surrounding male initiation rituals is found in both areas, the same exclusive possession of sacred flutes and trumpets that women are forbidden to see, the same belief that there was a time when women dominated men, and the same belief that men, either by trickery or force, had subsequently wrested power from women. Second, the Tucano origin myth makes it completely clear that the supernaturals departed after they had completed their work of preparing the Amazon for settlement by the migrants in the serpent canoe. Third, we are led to understand that direct contact between humanity and the spirit world would thereafter be broken. However, a portal, ayahuasca, through which humans could still travel to the spirit world and benefit from its teachings, would be left open. The leap to the Milky Way. Although any member of the Tucano community may drink ayahuasca, the deeper mysteries of the brew are primarily the work of the shaman, the paye, whose responsibility it is to travel through the portal whenever required to negotiate with powerful supernaturals on behalf of his community. Where matters of the greatest importance must be resolved, a group of paye will work together, consuming massive quantities of ayahuasca until they reach a point lying in their hammocks where they feel they are ascending to the Milky Way. The ascent to the Milky Way is not easily accomplished. An apprentice will hardly ever be able to rise immediately to this region, but rather will learn to do so after many trials. At first, he will barely rise over the horizon. The next time, perhaps, he will reach a point corresponding to the position of the sun at 9 a.m., then at 10 a.m., and so on until at last, in a single soaring flight, he will reach the zenith. In summary, therefore, the shaman's visionary journey through the ayahuasca portal involves a leap, or after sufficient practice, a soaring flight, to the Milky Way. It is not the final goal, however, but a way station. Beyond the Milky Way lies the entrance to the other world. As Rachel Dolmatoff explains, it is said that the individual dies when he drinks the potion, and that now his spirit returns to the uterine regions of the beyond, only to be reborn there and to return to his ordinary existence when the trance is over. This, then, is conceived as an acceleration of time, an anticipation of death and rebirth. Hidden Hand. The Tucano otherworld is divided into regions or districts, and one of these, of particular interest to shamans, is the domain of Vai Mahase, the supernatural master of animals. It is a strangely geometrical hill in the form of a square, with its four sides oriented to the cardinal directions. Is it an accident that geometry arises spontaneously in ayahuasca visions? And is it an accident that it does so not only among Amazonian peoples in the Amazon itself, but as my own experiences and multiple scientific studies have proved, among peoples from industrialized cultures as well? Whether you drink the brew in the rainforest, or in New York, London, Frankfurt, or Tokyo, it's a plain fact that sooner or later you are going to see geometry. Is the presence of some deeper enigma hinted at here? An enigma that the ancients had plumbed when they devised their memes and sent them ringing down the ages. Just because our high-tech civilization has demonized psychedelics for the last 50 years doesn't mean that other societies in the past did so. Indeed, it's likely that these powerful agents of transformation were used by ancient civilizations for profound and far-reaching inquiries into aspects of reality about which our own high-tech civilization remains willfully ignorant. We've seen that ayahuasca has many different names among the many different peoples who use it across the Amazon, but the word ayahuasca itself is from the Quechua language of the high Andes overlooking the western edge of the Amazon basin. This is the language that was spoken by the remarkable Inca civilization of Peru in the few short centuries before its destruction by the Spaniards. In that language, what ayahuasca means is the vine of the dead, or the vine of souls. The memes of geometry and cosmic alignment are not the only ones to have propagated from a so far unidentified common source. Intimately connected to them are other ideas that went viral in both the old world and the new, and that therefore somehow transcended the Ice Age separation of peoples. The central focus of all these ideas concerns the mystery of death, and anthropologists have long been aware that the Quechua name ayahuasca is entirely appropriate, since in the indigenous context, ayahuasca is intimately related to death. In parts 5 and 6, our investigation returns to North America, where eerie doppelgangers of the great earthworks of the Amazon haunt the Mississippi Valley. As we'll hear, it's almost as though what we're dealing with are the faint surviving traces of an immensely ancient, deeply thought-through system of knowledge and initiation, perhaps arising from direct investigations using vision-inducing plants, in which profound notions of the afterlife destiny of the soul were stitched together with the geometry and cosmic alignments into a single blueprint that was then hastily replicated and urgently distributed to the remotest corners of the earth.